Under federal law, all courts are required to provide language assistance to people who do not speak English in civil and criminal proceedings and for court programs and services. This directive comes from the Justice Department. Court interpreters are crucial to the state's court system, but finding an interpreter who speaks a rare language is a challenge. As Mary Lee Williams reports, a lack of interpreters can have serious consequences.
Could you please tell the court and the jury?
It's the last day of a two-day training for people who want to become certified court interpreters, and the classroom is full. The Hmong and Arabic speakers are practicing simultaneous interpreting, which is interpreting while being spoken to. Vab Aaron Zhang, a medical and civil interpreter, says she wants to get certified in Hmong. Her experience going through the court system as a kid influenced her decision to get certified.
Just because you can speak a language or two languages doesn't mean that you are qualified to interpret, period, let alone be a certified interpreter and know what all of the legal jargon was and all of the vocabulary and terms.
Wisconsin is in need of more certified court interpreters who speak rare languages, which is basically any language other than Spanish. Of the top five most frequently used languages last year, Hmong, Arabic, and Burmese don't have any fully certified interpreters living in the state of Wisconsin. Certified interpreters have to pass two tests, among other requirements. The oral test has a low pass rate. The state doesn't even offer a certification test for all languages, like Burmese. Carmel Kapati directs the court interpreter program in Wisconsin. She says the state needs more certified interpreters who speak rare languages. Kapati says unqualified people do come into court.
It's not just a challenge for our state, it's a challenge for all those other states that have, you know, immigrant and refugee populations of individuals who speak rare languages where they get to have their day in court too.
If one or sometimes two court interpreters can't be found in time for a trial, it can be put off, delaying justice. And if a judge notices a court interpreter isn't fulfilling their duties, they can stop everything and start over. Retired Dane County Circuit Court Judge Bill Faust worked with many interpreters during his career. He says a scheduling hearing doesn't necessarily need a certified interpreter, but contested trials are different.
You're risking having your whole court proceeding be overturned if it can later be proven that the interpreter was bad.
Enrique Soria is a certified Spanish interpreter. He says having a bad interpreter is like having a bad attorney. Soria says he once worked with somebody who misinterpreted a crucial answer to a question during a parental rights case. He says in that case, it could have changed the outcome. Interpreters work in teams during trials to make sure they catch mistakes like this, because court interpreting requires more than simply being bilingual. Still, Soria says mistakes happen.
That's why interpreters need to be trained and need to do study and need to have an extensive practice and observation so they can do this job well and do it correctly, because people's lives and careers and relationships are all at stake.
Carmel Kapati, who manages the court interpreter program, says her office is working with different departments like refugee services to try and recruit more people who speak rare languages. But it's hard when the tests are expensive, challenging, and the work is sometimes infrequent. Mary Lee Williams, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And to further this discussion on court interpreters, Carmel Kapati joins us. You heard from her in Mary Lee's story. Kapati manages the court interpreter program for the Wisconsin's court system. Carmel, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, let's first make a distinction here. Court interpreters are different than translators, and we shouldn't use those words interchangeably. Help us understand the reason.
Sure. When we talk about interpreting or interpreters, we're talking about people who are conveying oral messages, versus translators are individuals who are rendering written conversion of language, so documents between two languages.
And translators have, of course, the ability to look things up, go into dictionaries, take some time. Interpreters are doing all of this on the fly, in their own head.
Absolutely. So it's actually a different skill set. And while some interpreters do translations as well, if you think about it, interpreting is very, as you mentioned, on the spot. Interpreters don't have a lot of time to look terms up. Translators can look things up, research a particular word or a phrase, and have a little bit more time to produce an accurate equivalent.
So court interpreters, they're in the courtroom, lots of legal terminology going on. What do they have to think about in terms of language and how we communicate meaning and context?
It's really a very, very difficult job, court interpreting. First of all, it's a specialty or subspecialty of the overall profession of interpreting. And court interpreters have to not only be able to interpret in two languages, English and another language, but they have to be able to decipher what a particular legal term might mean and then convert that into another language. And all the time they have to monitor their accuracy, they have to make sure they're maintaining the register of the speaker.
When you say register, what do you mean by that? The intonation, or what do you mean?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when we're talking about register and when we're training interpreters to work in court, one important factor is we tell them that they need to maintain the register, and register is the formality of a language or the way that someone speaks. And that level of formality, whether it's a low register or a high register, might tell you, and especially it's important in a court proceeding, might tell the fact finder, such as the judge or the jury, something about the speaker. Because you had mentioned earlier about interpreting meaning, and meaning is, of course, what is said, but it's also how something is said.
Can you give us an example?
Sure. One of the examples that we use in our interpreter training could be something like, if someone speaks in a low register, it might sound something like, I told my bro to take a hike, or I'd kick his butt out of the house myself, versus a high register where someone might say, I told my brother to vacate the abode, otherwise I would personally have him removed. So you can see that the message is the same. You want the individual out of the house, but the way that it's said might tell you something about the speaker, a low register versus a high register.
Oh, and perhaps, you know, in a translation sense, the translator would perhaps consult an Urban Dictionary, maybe, versus, you know, the Oxford Dictionary.
Right, because, well, that's another thing that you bring up, because in a court proceeding, interpreters never really know what's going to be said in court, and sometimes an idiomatic expression might be used, or slang, or something that, you know, they do need to look up or that they might not be familiar with. So interpreters, above all, are linguistic experts, and they have to have a wide variety of knowledge on many, many different topics.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Carmel Kapati, and she is managing the court interpreter program for the Wisconsin Supreme Court system. You can join in the discussion, 800-642-1234. Have you ever needed an interpreter? Under what circumstances did you need someone to help you communicate? Join in, 800-642-1234. Carmel, what type of situation are we in terms of staffing? Because for some interpreters, this is a part-time position, a part-time gig.
Yes, I would say that for Spanish interpreters who do get certified, meaning they obtain their credential to be working in court, they can probably make a pretty much full-time living doing interpreting. For most other languages, I would say it is a part-time job, just because in our state, the demand is not there for all the other languages that we do see in the courts. And just to give some bit of reference, last year in 2016, the courts needed interpreters in about 55 different languages. Spanish was still the most requested language, but then there's all those other languages where the need might have not been very frequent, but it was present. So, you know, it might not be something that a non-Spanish language interpreter could make a full-time living off of.
We're discussing the lack of court interpreters for rare languages this hour with Carmel Capati. She manages the court interpreter program for the Wisconsin Supreme Court system. Join the conversation, 800-642-1234. Are you fluent in a language other than English? Have you considered becoming an interpreter? Join in the discussion. We'll return after a news update. There is an exponentially growing need for qualified language interpreters. New York State's court system is working with the City University of New York to prepare multilingual students for the state's court interpreter screening exams. It's now a growing internship program and expanding within colleges around New York. Here in Wisconsin, we're learning about the shortage of interpreters with Carmel Capati. She manages the court interpreter program for the Wisconsin Supreme Court system. You can join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. What challenges do you see with recruiting people who speak rare languages to Wisconsin? Do you see solutions that could ease the burden on the criminal justice system? Are you an interpreter? What's the most difficult part of your work? 800-642-1234. Carmel, is being bilingual enough to communicate all the information that is flowing through the courtroom?
It is not enough, and that's one of the first things that we tell individuals who come to our training, that besides having the language skills necessary to do the job of interpreter, they also have to have interpreting skills as well, because interpreters in court, if you've ever seen them, they are interpreting in, I think in the story sort of mentioned it, simultaneous mode, and that is when the interpreter is interpreting as someone is speaking with a slight delay, and that mode in particular requires extremely agile speaking skills, because usually the proceedings are done pretty quickly and people are talking rather fast, and so interpreters need to be able to keep up. They need to have short-term memory skills. They need to be actively listening. They need to be analyzing the message of what is being said, but also what they are saying. So there's a lot of cognitive skills that are going on in addition to the language skills that are needed.
Analyzing the message, in particular what you just said there, is that meaning that they have to make sure they're not providing a particular advantage or disadvantage by what they say?
Yes, that's one of the ethical... we spend a lot of time during our training for interpreters on the ethical limitations that interpreters have, because they have a code of ethics that they need to comply with that is found under Supreme Court rule. And their job is not to give an advantage to someone who doesn't speak or understand English. It's to level the playing field. So it's to give the same experience that an English speaker would have to someone who does not speak English. They're not there to make the situation better or worse. They're there to make it equal.
What example in a courtroom have you seen or heard how interpretation could skew the court's impression of someone or some incident?
There was a case in one of our counties a number of years ago, and it was a pretty serious trial, and it involved a Spanish speaker who was, I believe he was convicted of a, or he was being charged with a sexual assault, and he was Spanish-speaking. He was on the stand testifying through a Spanish interpreter who, at that time, was not a certified Spanish interpreter. We were newer with our program, so we were just starting out with certification testing. And the individual was giving his testimony, and the judge, who happened to be a native Spanish speaker, determined that the interpretation was not accurate, and it was, it was altering the message that the individual was giving, and because of that, the judge declared a mistrial in that case, and which means that they had to stop the proceeding and start over at a later time when they could find interpreters who were able to do the job. So that's the most, that's probably the most serious case that I can recall in our state that resulted in a mistrial due to a inaccurate interpretation.
Finding interpreters to do the job, three of the top five languages used in Wisconsin's court system last year, they don't have fully certified interpreters living within the state. And those are Hmong, Arabic, and Burmese. What happens when you can't coordinate interpreters?
A couple of things that a couple of options are available to the court. If we cannot find a certified interpreter who can come to the court in person, then at times the courts will use interpreters via telephone or via video, like such as video conferencing or even Skype on occasion, from interpreters who might live in other states who do hold credentials to do the job. So technology has been quite helpful in those situations when we've been unable to find interpreters in person.
Well, let's discuss the certification process, and let's go to Liz in Hartford with a question. Hi, Liz. Oh, Liz just dropped, but she wanted to know how we get started in certification. How does this process go?
So if anybody is interested in court interpreting, they would first start the process by attending a two-day orientation or a two-day training, and we offer those. My office offers those three times a year in different parts of the state, usually in Madison, in Milwaukee, and in Wisconsin Rapids. And that's the very first step towards, first of all, learning more about the profession, but also trying to get certified if that's if that individual speaks a language where we do have a certification testing. And that's a mandatory first step for everybody who's interested in our program.
Okay, and then what happens?
So after the orientation, then there's a series of tests. So there's a written exam that's after the orientation, and then if an individual passes that written exam, then there would be an oral exam that can be scheduled. And again, we offer the testings at different times throughout the year, and they're on a cycle that individuals can complete. Oh, if someone were to get, were quite energized to get certified quickly, I would say probably the soonest one could do it would be in about six or 7 months total.
How extensive are the written and oral exams?
The written exam for first-time test takers is $50, and then the oral exam is $250. And the orientation costs $195. I would just note that for individuals who speak certain languages, we do have some scholarship funding available through the Refugee Services Office that help to defray some costs for individuals who speak specific languages.
We had an email from Paul who is wondering, why do we have to provide free language interpreters to people who are in the country illegally?
Well, if you know, the question is, first of all, you'd mentioned earlier in your story that federal law requires that the courts provide free language assistance services for all individuals who are trying to access their services. But also, interpreters are provided for victims of domestic violence, for deaf individuals. So it's not simply, if you know, you're thinking about interpreters for people who are here illegally, that's not always the case, that interpreters are provided only for people who are here illegally.
And we're going to get into sign language in a moment here, but let's now bring in Liz, who is with us in Hartford. Hi, Liz.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call
again.
Sure. I have a friend who a few years ago I found out was Norwegian. Her English is so perfect, we had no idea. And she's sleeping now, but I'm wondering, have you ever come across a case where you needed Norwegian? And I had missed the original response on how she would look into something like that, a website or a phone number or who she would get in contact with.
Liz, thanks for the call. Carmel, go ahead.
That's an interesting question regarding Norwegian. I've been at my position for about 13 years, and I don't recall there's ever been a need for a Norwegian interpreter in our state. However, Wisconsin is a member of a group or consortium of other states. So if other states are looking for a particular interpreter who they might not have, such as Norwegian perhaps, then I would reference that state to our interpreter who might be certified in that particular language. So even though an interpreter might be certified or has credentials in one state, they could be working in many other states where, you know, that state doesn't have that particular language.
And it's interesting, Carmel, I could search you have a search tool on the Wisconsin Supreme Court System website where you can pull up different counties, pull up different languages, and see the listing of all the interpreters. I think I counted statewide 150, about roughly 150 interpreters, but they come from all corners of either Wisconsin, neighboring states, and I saw some from California.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and some of the interpreters I think one of the ones from California might have a tie to Wisconsin, such as they have family here and they come back here regularly. So if you think about it, interpreters it's a profession where it's very transferable. So just because you live in one particular state doesn't mean that you have to work in that state. If you have credentials, that are rare, you can work in many other states that are looking for, that need your services.
You know, a courtroom is an intimidating place, even if English is your first language. How do interpreters negotiate the tenor of the courtroom?
That's a really great question. It's part of the training that interpreters have to go through, and the court can be a very intimidating place, and there are a lot of serious issues that are needing to be resolved in court. So interpreters have to be prepared to hear, certain details that may be not very pleasant to hear about, graphic details. Those are some of the things that we train them about. And interpreters also, their ethical requirements require them to remove themselves from a case if they are unable to fulfill their duties, such as because, you know, they might not know the specific terminology well enough, or because it's really not a type of case that they might be comfortable with. So interpreters have to have a certain level of self-monitoring as well, to know their limitations as well. But as I had mentioned earlier, sometimes you can't always predict what's going to happen in the context of a court proceeding.
As we spoke about the accuracy of court interpreting, it brings to mind this discussion we had on this program yesterday about filler words, words like and ah, and pauses in conversation. Those are all nuances then that the interpreter has to fold in to what is being said in the courtroom?
Absolutely, because if you think about it, even you and I talking, I've used a lot of ums or uhs or fillers or repetitions, and interpreters have to do that as well, because interpreters who are working in court are trained to, we call it, to produce a legal equivalence, and that means that they have to produce the same message of the speaker without adding anything, deleting, summarizing, anything, and that would include fillers or repetitions, because in a courtroom, a judge or a jury has to make credibility determinations all the time. You know, do you believe this individual? And the way someone speaks also might tell you something about the credibility of that individual, and that's extremely important in a court proceeding.
What about interpreters for people with disabilities? How does the court negotiate and work with that?
So it's the same idea. So sign language interpreters are provided for individuals who have disabilities, and normally that's because an individual is deaf. And for our state, our deaf and hard of hearing population is about like 3.2%. So our courts have to do the same thing that they would to try to locate, a Burmese interpreter or an Arabic interpreter with sign language. And that's also very hard because there are not that many certified sign language interpreters in our state as well. And the certified sign language interpreters who do work in court mostly live in the southern part of the state. So the northern half of the state would need to have to pay for those individuals to travel there.
Why is it important to be certified?
Because certification is a level of assurance and basically quality assurance that you are able to do the job. Certification usually involves testing and training and continuing ed requirements that work towards maintaining your credentials as well as first obtaining your credentials.
Federal law enforcement began investigating California's court system 7 years ago after receiving complaints that two Korean-speaking women had been denied court interpreters. Courts in other states have been examined as well. U.S. civil rights law bars discrimination based on national origin, but finding enough trained and certified court interpreters outside of the Spanish language is a challenge. We're talking about these challenges with Carmel Capati. She manages the court interpreter program for the Wisconsin Supreme Court system. Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you ever needed an interpreter? Under what circumstances did you need someone to help you communicate? Are you fluent in a language other than English? How difficult is it to go back and forth accurately between two languages? 800-642-1234. We'll continue the discussion after a check of the latest news. Wisconsin requires interpreters to hold a valid license before working, but some states it's not required for court interpreters to be certified. There are levels of proficiency. It's difficult to pass a written and oral exam. We're discussing the lack of interpreters for rare languages with Carmel Kapati. She manages the court interpreter program for the Wisconsin Supreme Court system. Your thoughts welcome as well, 800-642-1234. Are you an interpreter? What's the most difficult part of your job? Many people don't understand your role. Tell us about it at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Joel now in Menominee. Hi, Joel.
Yes, good morning. I appreciate the show. I just had two quick questions. The three languages you mentioned earlier, Burmese, Hmong, and Arabic, are those the three most common languages spoken besides English in Wisconsin? And so that was my first question. And the second one is, what would you suggest to someone like myself who speaks, I can speak Spanish fairly well, and then a couple other languages like Hmong a little bit. What would you suggest to someone like myself who would be interested in possibly doing something like with interpreting? What would you suggest that I do or steps that I would take?
Go ahead, Carmel.
Oh, thanks for calling in. To answer your first question about the languages, so the top language that is requested for the courts is Spanish, followed by sign language, and then the other three languages that you mentioned are, in fact, Hmong, Arabic, and Burmese, and that reflects just our refugee populations that have come into our state. Hmong, we've always had a high population of Hmong families in our state. Burmese and Arabic reflect also the refugee populations that have been coming in the last couple of years. And Arabic reflects refugees that have been coming in because of the war in Iraq. So that's just to give a little bit of context of the top languages that we had needed last year. And then to answer the question about what you would need to do, I would say come and check out our training. We would love to have you learn more about court interpreting, and we especially love individuals who can speak several languages, and I think that's the best way for you to determine if this is something that you might be interested in pursuing.
Well, Joel, thank you so much for calling in and for those questions. Carmel, we had a caller who couldn't stay with us, and she asked, what happens during a court proceeding if the interpreter doesn't know a word or gets behind and loses track of the conversation?
That's also a great question, and that will happen. So what does happen is that, let's say an individual is talking in court, and the interpreter might not be familiar with a particular term that's being used. So the interpreter would actually have to ask the judge if he or she could clarify the term, and the judge would have to grant the permission to do so. And then the interpreter would actually ask the individual, you know, you said term X, does that mean, you know, A or B? Can you clarify? And they might have a very short discussion, and then the interpreter would be able to interpret the meaning of the word. Or if it's something that could be looked up easily, that's also something that an interpreter would have to do. So clarification is always necessary to ensure accuracy.
So how often does this happen when we have to slow down or stop the proceeding to get some clarification or to walk back the conversation a bit?
It doesn't happen all the time. I would say for our interpreters who are trained, and if they are able to prepare for the assignment, meaning that they're able to review the court file and be able to understand, you know, what is the purpose of the hearing, who are the individuals involved, and then they have an understanding of what are some of the terms or phrases that might be coming up, and they would be able to prepare ahead of time. But again, sometimes people will say things that are not expected, and again, for maybe like a slang term that might be used, the interpreter would have to look it up, but it doesn't happen, regularly.
Carmel, we were talking before the news break about certified and not certified and sign language. You mentioned something about payments and if trying to get someone certified, but there's also payments. Can you clarify the point there?
Yes, I think you're talking about that there are fees that are required with getting certified. So the tests do require some payment of the individual who's taking the test.
I understood that part, but in terms of if you have an interpreter who is not certified, or you can choose between having a certified interpreter and there is a cost with that, how is that payment happening?
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So you mean if the court is trying to schedule an interpreter, they would negotiate with the interpreter the fees that he or she is charging, because most interpreters are going to work as contractors for the courts. So they set their fees, and you would negotiate the rates, and that's generally how interpreters are paid for. But the county pays the interpreters upfront, and the state reimburses the counties for interpreter expenses. So, interpreter services are a shared state-county expense for the courts.
Let's go to Cindy now in Appleton. Hi, Cindy.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead, Cindy.
I am very interested in your program today because I have a sister who is deaf. She lives in Washington, D.C. area, where she always is very lucky to find highly qualified interpreters. I'm so happy to hear that, at least as long as I've been listening, there's been no mention of the video devices that are sometimes used. We found that at hospitals when my mother was dying, they would put my sister in front of a machine and expect a person on that machine to interpret for her, which drove us all crazy because sign language interpreting is an art, and it does take a lot of education. And when you have poor interpreters, it's very, very frustrating to the deaf person.
Carmel, go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much for calling in. You had mentioned video remote interpreting is what we call, when an interpreter is appearing by video, but you mentioned the limitations of that, and particularly for sign language. It's always much better to have an interpreter in person, because sometimes, as you mentioned, for sign language, the video doesn't accurately convey the signs, and it's difficult for the interpreter to interpret, and also very difficult for the individual who is deaf to understand what is going on. And so there's so much at stake. You talked about being in a hospital setting or in a court setting, and we really rely upon our interpreters to be able to do the job and to have the qualifications necessary to do that job.
Well, Cindy, thanks for calling in. And Carmel, it sounds like an online translation system or interpreting system would fail to convey all of the complex elements happening in the courtroom.
Yes, and actually our state statutes do not allow interpreters to appear by audio or video means during trials, so we always need to get interpreters in person for trials. I would say that, video and, I mentioned telephone, obviously that wouldn't work for sign language, but it is an alternative or an option when for a short hearing or something that where testimony wasn't being taken or in an emergency situation where we couldn't find an interpreter in person. So it has its use, but it really should be limited to short, non-evidentiary hearings.
So if you could dream without budget constraints or workforce challenges, what would be the most ideal way that we would handle language interpretation in court?
So I think what would be a great idea, and we sort of already do this with other states, but we pool resources. And, you know, if an interpreter is, as I mentioned earlier, certified in a particular language in one state, that interpreter, I would hope, would get used in almost all the other states because they have the qualifications to the job and because they invested the money to actually get certified, they should be able to have most of the work. And so, you know, creating pools of, you know, certified interpreters in cooperation with other states and jurisdictions.
So they might, like, fly around the country or move around in waves or pools as they're needed?
Yes, because that would sort of, that would address the issue of not having enough work in one state. So if an interpreter who got certified, you know, in a rare language, let's say in the state of Washington, maybe didn't have a lot of work there, maybe there's pockets of that language needs in other states, so that interpreter who is certified could get work in other states, and that would, you know, make that investment into the certification process worth his or her while.
So in the last few seconds that we have with you, what's the big takeaway about interpreting that you want to leave us with in understanding this profession?
It's a profession that is greatly needed in our court system. It requires, as we mentioned, individuals who are bilingual, who have interpreting skills, and it also... It's required in all cases for our state, civil and criminal cases. So we use interpreters a lot. And I guess the big takeaway is that it's an important job because we're talking about constitutional rights and that individuals, all individuals who come to court are afforded. And interpreters provide that necessary communication bridge.
Carmel, thanks for your time. That was Carmel Capati. She manages the court interpreter program for the Wisconsin Supreme Court system. We led off the hour with reporting from WPR's Mary Lee Williams exploring the struggles in finding certified court interpreters in rare languages here in Wisconsin. This hour of the morning show was produced by Keely Baltina and Niaja Ellison. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is the Ideas Network.